few years ago, Ajahn Amaro and I were at a abbot's meeting in Thailand, and that was when Ajahn Sumedho asked him to leave Abayagiri and go to Amaravati to take over as abbot at Amaravati, so that all of a sudden his plate got full. And he and I were, well, we met up with Lumpa Liam. And Lumpa Liam, of course, knew what was going on. And then he said to Ajahn Amaro, he said, "So, you know, you're still as busy as ever, teaching retreats." And then he went on and said, "You know, if you look on it as work, it's going to be uncomfortable. It's going to be unpleasant." He said, "But if you look at it as an opportunity to do something good and to help other people do something good, then it ceases to be work in the same way." Said it by looking at it that way, it goes against the stream of the world, goes against the kind of the ways of the world, the habits of the world. He said, normally, in terms of a worldly way of looking at things, we always think in terms of what we get out of things. What is our, you know, what's the payback for it? And he said, if you just, you know, in taking on duties and engaging in activity, if you look on it in the way of giving up, then all you get back is emptiness. Mm-hmm. So that kind of attitude, because that's Lumpa Liam was particularly speaking about in that circumstance of taking on duties, taking on responsibility. But it applies to really how we approach our life, how we approach our practice. You know, we set ourselves up for frustration and difficulty if we, you know, if we're expecting something. I came to this 10-day retreat, and I thought I was going to get jhana and you know, and sort of penetrative insight. I mean, it's really difficult. But you know, when we pick up the practice and look in terms of, well, what can I give to it? What can I give that's good? What can I do that is wholesome? Then you realize that it's a whole different relationship. This is kind of another aspect of this flavor of that I've brought up a few times, of that sense of just right. You know, the just right isn't just it isn't a formula. It isn't written down. It isn't a detailed list that you can check off. It's an attitude. It's a way of holding. So that holding our practice with this sense of giving and giving up, chaka. There's a lot of lightness in that. You know, when we pay attention to the meditation object, one of the traditional images that's used of how we hold our meditation object is holding a baby bird in our hand. You know, if you hold it, it has to be held just right. And it's very delicate, and you know, if you don't hold it tight enough, then it just sort of flies away. If you hold it too tight, you'll crush it. So that it has to be held just right. So that this quality of just right and learning how to get a feel for that, take an interest in what that actually feels like. What does it feel like to give oneself to one's meditation object? Give oneself to taking an interest in reflecting on Dhamma, on the true nature of things. What's it feel like to just give oneself to it? Rather than, how can I get insight out of this? How can I get my mind peaceful? How can I get more energy out of this? How can I get... And you know, that has a whole different feel to it and a whole different result. And as I said, it's an attitude that we learn to bring into our meditation, but also into this is how we live a life of Dhamma. It's how one lives a life of Dhamma practice. Yeah, and it's delightful. I remember one time being on retreat in Chitra's forest for a year and I didn't have any duties. I'd been the abbot at Wat Nanachat for over 10 years and so I was able to just be in the forest and go down to Chitra's house for the alms food and go back to my dwelling place. And after being there on retreat for 6 months or something like that, it was about probably halfway through my retreat, there's an older Thai woman there who's lived in England for a long, long time. And she saw me and was asking how I was doing. She hadn't seen me for quite some time. And then heard that I was on retreat and, you know, what do I do? And I just sort of laid out my day, which didn't really consist of anything. Get up in the morning, do some yoga, sit meditation, do walking meditation, have some tea, sit meditation, walk meditation, go for the meal, come back, sit meditation, walk meditation, do some yoga, have some tea. And she just looked at me aghast. Isn't that boring? And, no, it's not at all. And you realize that when we give ourselves to the practice, it really fills the heart. And not demanding of the Dhamma, of the world, of anything around us, that it should be according to our preferences, our views and opinions, our likes and dislikes, then it's an exceedingly pleasant experience. Of course, it doesn't take much for the habits to kick in. But that's, you know, in terms of, you know, giving ourselves to that awakeness, to learn how to wake up to the habits. You know, so yeah, you're sort of in retreat and you know, say for myself, you know, a monk for decades and you're in retreat and, you know, some pathetic mental state comes up, you know, of, you know, some kind of desire or some sort of obsession. And, you know, we can take it as a personal statement of our own individuality, but yeah, all it is it's just arising of a mental phenomena. And when it's seen, no one can allow it to cease. Well, I probably won't be able to remember, it's been years since I thought of it. One of Ajahn Mun's disciples has a very short saying, but just speaking about mental formations, that The mental formations stick to us. It isn't that the mind actually sticks to them. It's sort of something like that. And then he said, the mental formations are dhamma. The jitta, the mind, is anatta. It's not self. And so that it's that seeing things in that not self nature that there can be movement of mind, there can be moods, there can be those manifestations of our habits and whatnot. But then they're seen as dhammas to be understood. And what is held by the mind, the heart, that is dwelling in non-self. I mean, it's not dwelling in non-self. It is. It isn't anything else but non-self. You know, and that's just right. Seeing things according to their nature. The whole collection of the Samyutta Nikaya, the collection of discourses on connected discourses, and the very first discourse is sort of sets the tone for the whole book, really. And it's just it's a very short verse of a Devata asking the Buddha, you know, Venerable Sir, how did you cross the flood? And the flood being an image for the flood of samsara, the flood of the world, the flood of greed, hatred, and delusion. And so then, you know, Venerable Sir, how did you cross the flood? And the Buddha replies, I crossed the flood by not pushing forward and not staying in place. And then the Deva asks, but how did you cross the flood by not staying forward and not pushing forward and not staying in place? And the Buddha said, when I pushed forward, I was whirled about. When I stayed in place, I sank. So therefore, I crossed the flood by not pushing forward and not staying in place. That middle way, that just right quality. And it isn't as if he's going into, you know, again, great detail of telling you exactly what just right is or what that middle actually is. But it's just that not pushing forward, not sinking, not getting whirled about. So that our practice, we have to learn how to pay attention to, you know, what is it that spins us out? What is it that stirs us up? What is it that makes the heart kind of sink, get heavy, get dull? And that's the inevitable, on a certain level, it's the difficulty of a practice is learning how to pay attention to what we're experiencing, what we're feeling. How does that change? How does it shift? What makes it shift? So that sense of paying attention to the actual experience, but then also paying attention to those, the causal conditions. One can't sort of just take an experience in isolation. Nothing stands isolated. All things arise through causes and conditions, and they pass away when those causes and conditions change or different. It's the understanding the process, paying attention to the process, getting a feel for that process of change. There's another discourse where the Buddha is asked by Kachayana Gotta, what's right view? You know, what is right view? And the Buddha, I say, rather than launching into a definition of right view, he pointed to the tendency of saying, you know, for the most part, you know, we're held in the kind of in the grip of a polarity of views. And we t- tend to either the view of existence, of being, of becoming, or a view of non-existence, of annihilation, of pushing away. And as long as we vacillate, move back and forth between those extremes, then we never understand right view and never put an end to suffering. And the Buddha said, when we pay attention to the arising of things, the coming into being of things, then the view of non-existence, of annihilation is, it doesn't hold sway or doesn't hold power. When we attend to the experience or the reality of the ending of things, the cessation of things, then that sense of kind of endless existence and a continuity of a permanence can't sort of hold sway. And he said, so it's this paying attention at the right and appropriate times to these different aspects to get a balance. And when we really look at things, rather than it being separate phenomena or separate feelings of self or of me, of mine, arising and ceasing, it is just dukkha arising and dukkha ceasing. Again, that sense of it's just what it is. It's how phenomena works. Then the Buddha goes in, in order to stay with that investigation, it's really paying attention to the causal processes of how things do arise. And that's what Buddha pointing to dependent origination. Not so much in its the nitpicky little detail, but the causal processes, paying attention to the causal processes of how things come to be and how they cease. And that's when we pay attention to that, then we can step back from that habit, the tendency of drifting to polarities of this is like this, it's going to be like this, it's always going to be like this, or the polarity of this is awful, it's ending, it's cessation, it's all chaos and destruction. It's just this arising and ceasing. And that's how the Buddha defines right view. When we can step between those habits of the mind that swing to the extremes of view. And again, that's the sense of just right. So it's not something that we having a pat answer for everything, having the sort of like your Buddhist cheat sheet that you can check up and sort of get the little short, quick answer for things. You actually have to be present, pay attention to things, be able to get a feel for how to be in balance with the experiences that we have. And that's why meditation, you can't just take a method and plunk it onto the experience of the mind or of the breathing or whatever, and the mind will become peaceful. It doesn't really work that way. Or even if it does become peaceful, it'll tend to not be very stable. It won't be very consistent. When the Buddha describes the characteristics of, say, of samadhi, one of the characteristics is of course, it's calm and steady. There's this kind of steadiness and calm and clarity. These are typical characteristics. But then there's also the quality of malleable. The mind is malleable. It's not rigid. It's not fixed. There's a malleability to the mind that allows it to adapt to circumstances. And whether it's a You know, as you're meditating and tuning to the subtleties of the sensation of the breath or the subtleties of the quality of the mind, there's a malleability that is there, and it's able to adapt, adjust. Another quality that the Buddha points to of samadhi, and there's a few words that there's stock phrases, standard stock phrases that the Buddha uses, is kamaniya, which is sort of like, is it ready for work? It's actually, it's ready for the work of either refining or settling more, or it's ready for the work of investigating and contemplating. So that there's a balance of mind, that kind of just right quality. It's attuning itself to what's useful, what's beneficial. And, you know, and of course, well, what is the work? The work is freeing the heart from suffering, freeing the heart from its limitations and complications. So that as we cultivate and develop, that attuning our alertness and our discernment to see what is going to be useful. Because sometimes it's useful to really arouse determination, arouse effort. Sometimes it's useful to learn how to step back, learn how to relax. Is one right, one wrong? And it's not, you can't sort of say that, because it has to be what is just right for the purpose of freeing the heart from its stress, its discontent. So that learning how to work with the mind, taking an interest. And it isn't having, you know, some kind of extra knowledge or anything. It's very interesting that a lot of the great forest masters, you know, they certainly didn't get their PhDs in Buddhist studies, you know, at some good university. They're village people for the most part, and they definitely had an understanding of the human condition. Brajan Cha saying, sometimes having too much knowledge is an obstacle. He said, it's like if you've got a mango tree and the mangoes are about 15 feet up or something, and the way you collect mangoes in Thailand is you have a little wicker basket. It's like a wicker basket like this, and it's about halfway, and you put it in, and then you can hook it and bring it down, because mangoes get bruised really easily. He said, so if you've got your mangoes are up there about 15 feet or so, but you've got a 30-foot pole, you don't really, you have difficulty getting those mangoes. it isn't as if just because you've got a PhD you're going to understand Buddhism. A whole bunch of knowledge of the scriptures that it's actually going to help. So often he would, especially for us as Westerners, but in general he would really say, you know, put the books down, learn how to read your heart. You know, we're always looking for some kind of affirmation externally, or some bit of knowledge that we can be comfortable with. And just to trust our own hearts is, it's a bit scary. You know, of course, we were always pestering him with questions and trying to get more information and trying to get more understanding and trying to get it real clear. and get more information, more knowledge. And remember him one time kind of utter frustration, sort of saying, you know, you Westerners, you're just trying to, you think too much, he says, it's like a vulture. You know, vultures fly really high, but look what they come down to eat. it's getting everything sawed out with all sorts of nice high thoughts of logic and Buddhist theory, but we keep coming back to greed, hatred, and delusion. And keep creating suffering for ourselves. Learning how to pay attention, get that balance of attending to, it's just attending to the ordinary things of our existence. It's just in that ordinariness of the Dhamma. Also, there's actually a discourse. It's sort of the orderliness of the Dhamma. The Dhamma Niyama Sutta, the sense of orderliness of the Dhamma. And it's a very simple sutta where the Buddha just sort of says, whether a Buddha appears in the world or doesn't appear in the world, all things are impermanent. Whether a Buddha appears in the world or doesn't appear in the world, all formations, sabbe sankhara anicca, all formations are impermanent, all formations are dukkha. Whether a Buddha appears in the world or doesn't appear in the world, all dhammas are not self. This is the orderliness of the Dhamma. This is true wherever you go, whatever era, whatever place you find yourself, whether it's internal, external. It's this sense of this is the nature of things. And it's this nature of things that when we see it and bring it into the heart, it allows us to release. It allows us to let go. It allows us to put things down, putting down a burden of suffering. One of the images that Ajahn Chah used, those contemplations of anicca, dukkha, anatta, that investigation of that orderliness of the Dhamma, that nature of things. He said, when we don't do that, he said, it's like tightening a nut. And you just keep getting it tighter and tighter, and you keep turning it tighter, and keep making it tighter. And he said, but when we contemplate and see, understand that anicca, dukkha, anatta, impermanence, unsatisfactory, non-self, sort of like taking that nut and unscrewing it, and it just starts releasing, it starts coming out, and that's it works in that way. And so that paying attention to the natural order of things, paying attention to how to encourage and incline the mind, the heart, to that quality of just right. Okay, so let's do it rather than thinking about it or listening about it.